former GCW promoter Jim Barnett, who had jumped to WWF after being ousted by Ole, and who just happened to be a close personal friend of Turner's. Barnett negotiated a deal between Vince and Jim Crockett Jr., the then promoter of Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling, which enabled Crockett to purchase the TBS slots with exclusivity for $1 million. Turner was ecstatic. Not only was he rid of Vince, but he had also regained popular wrestling stars like Dusty Rhodes and Ric Flair. Plus, Crockett agreed to do what Vince wouldn't, promote a local Atlanta studio wrestling show. Watts felt betrayed. He claimed Turner had promised to give him McMahon's time slots when McMahon's contract expired, only to turn around and give them to Crockett instead. Despite the affront, on the final episode of Mid-South Wrestling, Watts went on television and put over Crockett's performers, saying fans would get to see great NWA action from now on. Vince, however, gave Crockett a very stern warning, noting, quote, "You'll choke on that $1 million." Heading up the top two promotions in the country, McMahon and Crockett continued to feud over the next several years. The smaller territories couldn't compete with the level of TV exposure these companies had, and subsequently most died off. Among the promoters who didn't make it was Watts, who tried to go national after losing the TBS slots, but couldn't afford it in the end. He was paying for national syndication, but was losing $50,000 each week due to a combination of falling business and economic turmoil in the region. He finally sold to Crockett for $4 million, although he only ended up receiving $1.2 million when all was said and done, because Crockett, despite having had a great two-year period under Booker Dusty Rhodes after the McMahon TBS buyout, ultimately couldn't afford to go national either. After buying Watts' company, which was known as the Universal Wrestling Federation at the time, you know, because the universe is bigger than the world, and seriously, that's why it got the name, Crockett Promotions booked an ingenious invasion angle that consisted of having all their guys destroy all of the UWF guys, making them look like total losers. Crockett didn't know how to book, noted Bill Watts. He never booked. He couldn't book, so he was at the mercy of his booker. And Dusty was a brilliant person, but if you look at Florida, it went broke under Dusty. Every place he booked went broke. Because as good as he was at drawing gross gates, he had no consciousness of a bottom line. Nothing was bottom line oriented. And Crockett couldn't make the tough management decisions needed to rein it in. In terms of bad booking, Crockett was years ahead of his time, because like the WWF/WCW invasion in the summer of 2001, the plan was so ingenious that instead of building to a period of business boom built around a promotion versus promotion war, they killed the invaders immediately, and it died a painfully quick death. Crockett had many brilliant ideas, few of which would ever be learned from. He signed guys to huge guaranteed deals he couldn't afford. He snubbed loyal fans by moving Starrcade, the NWA equivalent of WrestleMania, out of the South for the first time ever and running it in Chicago instead. He flew himself and the top stars around in an expensive private jet and partied it up on the flights. Scratch that. He didn't have a, as in one private jet. He actually had two of them, and thus had to keep two pilots on payroll at all times. And he allowed Dusty Rhodes to ultimately book the company into oblivion, with cheap finishes that outraged fans. In fact, Dusty's penchant for having a babyface or good guy win a belt or match and then later reversing it became commonly known within the industry as a Dusty finish. Dusty himself actually got the finish from Booker Eddie Graham when he was learning pro wrestling in Florida in the 1970s. Another Crockett moment of genius saw mid-carder Ron Garvin beat perennial champ Ric Flair for the world title, then saw Garvin, who we remind you was a babyface, announce he would not be defending the title again until Starrcade. What? Although Garvin was supposedly the hero prior to his title win, fans didn't see him as a man who should be beating the Nature Boy, and ratings plummeted from the 4.0 range to a 2.8. Fastest drop in history. In late 1987, Crockett announced that the annual Thanksgiving Night Starrcade show would be broadcast for the first time on pay-per-view on November 26th. Like McMahon did with the first WrestleMania, Crockett was betting his company's existence on this show's success, having run up some huge debts with all of his crazy spending. McMahon, knowing the stakes were high for Jim Crockett Promotions, announced that he was going to be running a Thanksgiving night pay-per-view as well, the first annual Survivor Series. Crockett didn't want to run head-to-head with McMahon, who was doing great pay-per-view numbers at the time, so he offered to move the Starrcade show to Thanksgiving afternoon. The cable companies were thrilled to hear this, since they expected wrestling fans to buy both shows and basically sit in front of their TVs watching wrestling all day. But McMahon had other ideas. He announced that any company that aired a Crockett's pay-per-view would not be allowed to air Survivor Series or the next WrestleMania, since he was the established king of wrestling pay-per-view at the time, and since WrestleMania III had been such a huge financial success that it basically made the genre, all but five companies across the country chose to air the Survivor Series over Starrcade. Crockett was dead in the water before his show even aired. Struggling to keep his company alive, Crockett planned his revenge. He booked his next pay-per-view, the Bunkhouse Stampede, at the Nassau Coliseum, a building right in the middle of McMahon's home territory. Nobody is quite sure why he thought this was such a great idea, because his product had absolutely no history in the area, and it inevitably bombed at the gate, drawing just 6,000 fans and $80,000. But it got worse. McMahon had a plan of his own. To air the first ever Royal Rumble, a modified battle royal in which new men enter the match at 2-minute intervals, live from Hamilton, Ontario on the USA Network, head-to-head with Crockett's pay-per-view. The Rumble ended up doing an 8.2 rating, the highest number for any wrestling show in history on that network, and that includes the Monday Night Wars. And if all of that wasn't bad enough for Crockett, the Rumble was widely regarded as the superior show since Crockett's pay-per-view, headlined by Flair versus Road Warrior Hawk, had yet another hackneyed, dusty finish. But Crockett was not yet done. His next idea was to run a free Clash of the Champions on TBS on March 27, 1988, head-to-head with WrestleMania IV. This time, his plan was somewhat of a success, as the Clash did a 5.8, and the Flair vs. Sting main event ended up being, at the time, the most watched match in the history of cable television, peaking at a 7.8. WrestleMania IV, on the other hand, was a miserable show headlined by Randy Savage, who beat Ted DiBiase to win the vacant WWF title. Despite Vince having done exactly the same thing with the Royal Rumble, the cable industry was irate with Crockett and Turner for having the audacity to air a free show opposite WrestleMania, despite the fact that Mania did 585,000 buys, the most in history. The problem was that the universe for pay-per-view had doubled that year, and even though they set a purchase record, the feeling was that the show would have done substantially better without the competition. Wrestling companies were starting to make the bulk of their money through pay-per-views, and cable companies were getting a nice slice of the pie, to the tune of approximately 60% of the gross. Turner was told never to allow something like that to happen again. To make matters worse, CNN ran a news story on the major pro wrestling show of the day, and it was WrestleMania. Turner's own wrestling company was completely ignored in the story. Despite the Clash's huge success, Crockett was informed shortly thereafter that his company was going broke. The disastrous year, the huge money contracts he was paying off, and all of his jet flying and limousine riding and kiss stealing and wheeling and dealing were finally coming to roost. Crockett himself would later admit that he loved the lifestyle too much. "I probably had too many beers with the boys," he noted. That was back in the day. They were great people to be around. Crockett figured he would make huge money on pay-per-view and through national advertising. Unfortunately, Vince had stomped all over his pay-per-views, and advertisers believed only inbreds watched pro wrestling and weren't willing to pay much for the commercial time. And to be fair, that is a feeling that exists to this day. At the time of this writing, WWE Raw is one of the highest-rated programs on all of cable television. Despite having a massive audience, their ad rates are far, far lower than programs drawing half their ratings. "The reason it happened was because maybe I had too much ego," Crockett himself noted about Crockett Promotions' collapse. Maybe I should have brought in people with expertise in areas other than wrestling. People that don't like Dusty will say it was Dusty's fault. I don't know why people would ever blame Dave Johnson, my accountant. He almost went nuts trying to save the company, trying to tell me what was really happening, because he understood all the ramifications of cash flow. If anyone is to be blamed, it's me. Turner got wind that things were bad and took an interest in buying. He had a soft spot in his heart for wrestling, as the success of Barnett's program years earlier had helped to convince him that he hadn't made a mistake and that his superstation could indeed be a success. So, late in the summer of 1988, shortly after Crockett took out $600,000 in loans to make payroll, Turner purchased Jim Crockett Promotions for $9 million. While Turner didn't end up owning the entire NWA, he did own its biggest member promotion and its biggest stars. The Crockett family was given a minority interest, they were bought out a few years later, and everyone in the family was given a job. This included Jim himself, who after all of his years in the business became a consultant whose ideas were never used. In the following years, audiences sat through the highs and lows of what would become World Championship Wrestling, thinking to themselves that as horrible as some of it was, with a billionaire like Ted bankrolling everything, it would never go out of business. "I'm sure you have most of the stupid stories," said Jim Cornette of his memories of the promotion, "but one of my favorites was when they booked center stage for TV, and we all showed up, only to find it in the middle of renovations with no seats in the building, just concrete ledges with dust all over them. And so we had to do TV the next day in Huntsville. Or the time we did a big angle on the Saturday night show at center stage and somehow they didn't record it. Or letting Iron Sheik's $100,000 contract roll over for another year after they only used him about 10 times that year. I never mind being on the record about how stupid WCW was." For the early years of WCW's life under the Turner Empire, the booking duties ping-ponged between two men, Dusty Rhodes and Ole Anderson. Amazingly, despite both having had successful booking runs in regional promotions in the past, neither man seemed to have any clue as to how to run a wrestling company on a national basis. Both had their own agendas, namely pushing themselves and their friends to the high-paying main event slots. And when things didn't go their way, they tended to act like little babies, doing things that did neither the company nor, ironically, themselves any good. A perfect example of this came in 1988, after Dusty and WCW Vice President Jim Herd had a blow-up. Dusty was upset at Ric Flair, and as a result wanted to book him to lose the NWA title in 5 minutes to Rick Steiner at Starrcade. The idea was that Steiner was a legitimate tough guy, and if Flair was in the ring with him, Flair would have no choice but to drop the title, even if he didn't want to. Flair was so upset that he threatened to quit the company. Herd didn't want him gone, so he went over Dusty's head as booker and instead put Flair versus Lex Luger at Starrcade, which Flair won. Dusty, outraged that he'd been usurped and upset with the decree that there be no more blood or weapons on TV, retaliated by having the Road Warriors come out to the ring, grab a huge metal spike, hold him, and jam it into his eye. Suffice to say, Rhodes' orbital socket soon resembled a crimson version of Old Faithful. To the shock of no one, save perhaps Dusty himself, Herd immediately fired him as booker, and within a few weeks, fired him as talent as well. With WCW no longer his home, Dusty looked north for employment, turning to Vince McMahon and the WWF. McMahon was more than happy to welcome him to the WWF. He even bought him some new outfits. And what outfits they were, with Dusty's flabby frame somehow squeezed into the tightest latex imaginable. Oh, and gigantic bright yellow polka dots. He was introduced to WWF fans through a series of asinine vignettes in which he delivered pizzas, cleaned toilets, and shoveled horse crap. See, that's the way a lot of folks in wrestling operate. You, the promoter, don't like someone in a rival organization. Circumstances arise in which that person is unemployed and in need of a job. Instead of simply denying him employment, you bring him into the company and completely humiliate him. Do the fans in the stands want to see this? No. Does it matter? No, because it's all about showing the guy you don't like who has the power. The polka dot outfits weren't the first time McMahon took a shot at Rhodes either. In 1987, the WWF created a manservant character named Virgil, so named because Rhodes' real first name was Virgil. If that wasn't childish enough, years later when the WWF's Virgil jumped to WCW, he was renamed Vincent as a shot against Vince McMahon. Vincent slash Virgil ended up making a career out of spoofing folks, as later in his WCW tenure, he was renamed again, becoming Shane, an inside rib on Vince McMahon's son. Which persona was most memorable? Well, to this day, Mr. Mike Jones can be seen on the wrestling convention circuit, and elsewhere, randomly, usually alone at an empty booth with a black and white sign that reads, Wrestling Superstar Virgil. The image of him sitting alone with no fans within 1,000 yards has been immortalized countless times on the internet, including on a website entitled LonelyVirgil.net. The stellar booking of Ole Anderson in 1990 cannot be ignored. During the period, he scripted many incredible angles, including a match between Sting and Sid Vicious, wherein the WCW title changed hands for approximately 45 seconds. During the encounter, Sid and Sting fought towards the backstage area, then returned to battle in the ring. However, when Sting came back, he'd apparently grown 6 inches in height and about 50 pounds in weight. He lifted Sid up for a body slam, collapsed, likely from gaining 50 pounds in the span of 30 seconds, and was immediately pinned. New champion. But wait. No. It turns out that Sting was actually Barry Windham in disguise, and the real Sting emerged from the back, and then he pinned Sid to keep the title. How exactly the referee, who had just counted the other Sting down for a 3 count, suddenly deciphered that the real Sting had been taken to the back, beaten up, and replaced by Windham in less than a minute, was never explained. For the record, though, to this day, Sid Vicious states that not only did he not know what was going to happen ahead of time, he also was unaware that the man he pinned was not actually Steve Borden. I didn't even know that, Sid notes. I didn't know anything. I didn't know Barry Windham was even in the building. I don't think anybody did. If they did, maybe I wasn't the only one that didn't. I ran Sting through the back door. I was told he was supposed to come back out holding his head like somebody whacked him. And when he got back in the ring, I just rolled him up. 1, 2, 3. When he got in there, of course, it wasn't him, it was Barry, and I didn't notice it until I got him down. I still had not been told anything. I had to use some quick thinking there. Quick thinking! Suddenly, some of the interviews the big guy did in the dying days of WCW make more sense. With Sting having dispatched Sid and the company not wanting to push Flair as his challenger for whatever reason, likely because he was too old, yes, in 1990, a new foe was needed, and thus Ole unveiled his greatest creation, a mystery man known as the Black Scorpion. The Scorpion was a masked being, we weren't sure he was a wrestler, at least in the beginning, who would be shown in what appeared to be a black-lit closet, giving Sting cryptic clues to his identity and their shared past. Oh yes, you know me, the Scorpion explained via a garbled voice box recording of Sting, or at least you did. But don't try to track me down, it won't help. Even if you saw my face in light, you wouldn't recognize me. My face doesn't look the same. He then promised that he would make Sting terrified. And terrified would describe anyone who bore witness to Scorpion's live appearances wherein he generally chose not to wrestle, but rather perform his evil black magic. Evil black magic. Such sorcery included, but was not limited to, sticking a dude's head in a box and spinning it around like a top, and then throwing him into another box and turning him into a tiger. Really, we're not making this up. This was to entice folks to spend their hard-earned cash on a wrestling match. Behind the scenes, things were just as laughable. Despite all this build, there was no real plan as to who precisely the Scorpion would be unveiled to be. You'd think that that would have been a prerequisite going into such an angle, but as you'll soon learn, logic and WCW often chose not to coexist. All of this tomfoolery led to the biggest pay-per-view of the year, in which Sting would finally battle the Scorpion mano a mano inside a steel cage. As Gary Michael Capetta announced these stipulations, the Black Scorpion made his way to the ring, followed by another Black Scorpion, then another, and another. Eventually, a giant spaceship lowered from the ceiling, from which the real Scorpion emerged. Yes, the Scorpion was able to not only perform magic, but travel intergalactically as well. You ready to drop some coin yet? So Sting came down to the ring, without the aid of a flying saucer, and the two had a match. And for those in attendance, it was a somehow familiar match. And this would make sense, as following the defeat of the Scorpion, Sting ripped the mask off to reveal, oh yes, Ric Flair. Somehow, this led to Ole being fired. Shocking, we know. His replacement? Dusty Rhodes, of course. Dusty, after being made to look like a complete jackass in the WWF, returned once more to the Turner Empire, this time to clean up the mess Ole had made in 1990. Who knows why anybody would have thought that rehiring him was a good idea, given his track record of pissing off upper management and booking himself as the star of the territory. The man behind the decision was Jack Petrick, who was in charge of the Turner Wrestling Division at the time. He felt that Dusty's problem was that he always booked everything around himself, so his solution was to bring him back with the stipulation being that Dusty could book, but not wrestle. Dusty came out flying, too, with one of his greatest creations, War Games. It was a 10-man tag match that placed two rings side by side and surrounded both with a steel cage. The participants entered the cage in 2-minute intervals. A coin was tossed beforehand, and the winner of the toss would have the upper hand throughout the opening stage of the match, with a 2-on-1, then a 3-on-2, a 4-on-3, and finally a 5-on-4 advantage. The match could not be decided until all 10 men had entered, at which point the match beyond would begin. It was an ingenious concept, and it created some memorable bouts. Wrestle War was no exception, as top heel Sid Vicious nearly sent Brian Pillman through the roof of the cage before depositing him neck first on the mat. If Dusty was looking to impress his bosses, old or new, he did just that in booking this showdown. It wasn't just madness in the ring, though. For instance, the company was looking to diversify its portfolio by dipping its toe into electronics. Really? Look, we don't blame you for not believing us, so let's let the New York Times tell you the story. The group, WCW, is working on electronic contraptions to heighten interest among children. When completed, the gadgets will be shown to focus groups of young fans to get a reading on them. In development, for instance, is a rage meter that will somehow measure the amount of rage a wrestler is feeling at any given time. Fans will be able to learn, say, whether a wrestler who has just had his teeth kicked out feels blood-curdling rage or perhaps just mild displeasure. Another device being studied is a slam meter. It will reveal the force of a slam to the mat. Was it a backbreaker of a slam? Was it a career ender? How much money was spent on what was certain to be a miraculous piece of electronics is unknown, as it was never mentioned again. There were no American pay-per-views until May, but the company did put on a co-promotional show with New Japan Pro Wrestling in Tokyo called Rumble in the Rising Sun, featuring stars from both promotions, but sadly, no rage or slam meters. The event featured world champ Ric Flair dropping his title to Tetsumi Fujinami. Kind of, sort of. The storyline was that Fujinami pinned the champ, but this happened after Flair was thrown over the top rope, grounds for a disqualification in WCW. It was not, however, grounds for a DQ according to New Japan, so Fujinami was recognized by that group as the NWA World Champion. This led perfectly into WCW's next domestic pay-per-view, Super Brawl. The show saw Flair regain the title in a decent match, as well as a rare babyface versus babyface showdown between the most popular tag teams in the company. Sting and Lex Luger took on the Steiner Brothers in a match that absolutely tore the house down. Sadly, just as Scott Steiner appeared to be catching fire, he suffered a torn biceps that put him out of action for about a year. The only other notable match on the show featured Elegante, beating Sid Vicious in a match known to cause nightmares for anyone fool enough to watch it. Vicious was leaving for the WWF. His WCW contract didn't expire until the fall, but WCW agreed that if he lost to Igante in a stretcher match, where the loser had to be taken out of the building on a stretcher, they'd let him out of his deal early. However, they told him that if he no-showed Super Brawl, they wouldn't give him a release, and he wouldn't be able to go to WWF until September. WWF obviously urged him to show up. WCW was so certain he wouldn't show up that the format backstage listed the match as Igante versus One Man Gang. But alas, Sid did show up to participate in an all-time terrible battle described by Dave Meltzer as a match that appeared to feature two blind men wrestling. He lost as scheduled, but instead of being carted out on a stretcher, he just stood up immediately after being pinned and walked out. And WCW still let him out of his deal. As bad as this was, nothing could compare to the fiasco that occurred in June, when one of the biggest wrestling cataclysms ever took place. To explain how it all began, let's back up a bit and look at what had been going on behind the scenes between Ric Flair and WCW Vice President Jim Herd. Herd felt that Flair, at 42 years old, was over the hill and ought to be replaced. He even went so far as to claim that Flair should cut his trademark bleached blonde hair, wear an earring, and change his name to Spartacus. Perhaps most of all, however, he didn't care for Flair's contract. Flair was the highest-paid wrestler in the company at a time when they were losing millions every year. The animosity wasn't one-sided, however, as Flair didn't see Herd as anything more than a corporate suit. And indeed, looking at his employment history, that's exactly what he was. Herd had been a higher-up at Pizza Hut prior to his arrival at Turner. Obviously, the two businesses were radically different. To be fair, Herd did have a minor background in wrestling, in a former life working as a television director for Wrestling at the Chase under Sam Muchnick in St. Louis. But despite his friendship with Muchnick, one of the great promoters in wrestling history, Herd had a tough time grasping some of the basic concepts of pro wrestling, including the notion that WCW fans would pay to see Ric Flair perform. Flair was willing, unhappy but willing, to take a massive pay cut to sign a new 2-year deal, less than half of the $750,000 per year he had been making. Herd refused. The two bickered back and forth for months, with Herd calling for Flair to drop the WCW title repeatedly, and Flair refusing to do so unless his contract demands were met. In the end, Herd finally just gave up and fired Flair before Flair had a chance to drop the title. The plan was that WCW would declare the title vacant. All fine in theory, but unfortunately for WCW, Herd failed to realize that Ric Flair, despite now being billed as the WCW champion, was still technically the NWA World Heavyweight Champion, and thus believed he owned the physical belt. While the NWA largely only existed on paper at that point, WCW was not only promoting Flair as their company champion, but also as the NWA National Wrestling Alliance champion, an organization to which they still belonged and whose rules they still had to follow. The NWA board, which didn't really exist in 1991 since most of the promoters had been put out of business by then, was supposed to vote on and approve all title changes. In those days, the NWA champion leased the belt, meaning he had to put down a $25,000 deposit, which was held in case he refused to drop the title when asked. Since Flair never lost the belt in the ring and never got his $25,000 back from either the NWA or WCW, he just figured the belt was his to do with as he pleased. He even went so far as to send the belt to Vince McMahon, who began showing it on his television shows. Manager Bobby Heenan claimed that the real world champion was on his way to the WWF. Fans watching WWF TV at home were stunned to see this turn of events and eager to finally see the long-awaited dream match, WWF champion Hulk Hogan versus WCW/NWA champion Ric Flair. The Hogan versus Flair series in the WWF ironically turned out to be something of a disappointment. Despite years of wrestling magazines hyping it as the biggest potential match in wrestling history, the WWF gave it a run on house shows. This was puzzling, as most thought it could easily be a WrestleMania main event. There were apparently those within the company who viewed Flair as solely a regional act, and thus relatively little promotion was given to what was his first match with the WWF's biggest star. That first match took place in Dayton, Ohio, on October 21, 1991, in what was originally scheduled to be a bout between Flair and Roddy Piper. Hogan and Flair wrestled again 3 days later in Oakland, California, which according to WWE canon was their first match. While the early bouts in the feud drew very well, it quickly fell off. It appeared that the longer Flair was on WWF television, the less drawing power he had. The appeal was truly when Flair was WCW champion, and when it became obvious Flair was just another WWF performer, people tired of it. Following the 1992 Royal Rumble, where Flair won the title, WrestleMania 8 was originally promoted as Hogan versus Flair. That was soon scrapped, however, with Flair instead battling Randy Savage. The feeling was that Hogan versus Sid Vicious slash Justice was a bigger main event to the masses than Hogan versus Flair. Plus, with Hogan leaving to shoot a movie after WrestleMania, it made no sense for him to beat Flair, and he wasn't losing, and then disappear with the belt. At the end of the day, despite both having appeared in the company at the same time in both the 90s and the 2000s, the greatest dream match of the 1980s, Hulk Hogan versus Ric Flair, never took place at WrestleMania. Hearn may have breathed a sigh of relief when Flair left WCW, but once that belt showed up on WWF TV, chaos erupted within the entire company. Hearn caught hell from everyone, from Turner officials to the wrestlers themselves. It certainly didn't help that Ted Turner's personal favorite wrestler was Ric Flair. Hearn immediately went into a full-blown panic and tried to lure Flair back into the company with an offer twice what Flair had offered to stay for originally. In other words, back to $750,000 per year or so. Flair, irate with how everything went down and having already made a verbal agreement with McMahon, told him no. Unable to get Flair back, Hearn knew he damn well had to recover that title. WCW went as far as to have Jim Barnett, and yes, he's back, convince one of the seven members of the NWA board to switch his allegiance to the side of the WCW members of the board. Gary Juster, Jim Crockett Jr., and yes, Jim Hearn. Which then allowed Hearn to be named the new NWA president and give WCW controlling interest over the NWA title. This allowed them to proclaim Lex Luger the current NWA champion, after which a lawsuit was filed that eventually forced Flair to return the belt. It also set a legal precedent that would have a major impact on wrestling years later. The court ruled that a pro wrestling belt was a valuable symbol for the promotion it represented, and if Flair continued to wear it on WWF TV, WCW could sue for damages. So the WWF tried to make a fake WCW belt for Flair to wear. Court was not happy. So WWF gave him a tag belt and digitized it on television. The court still wasn't thrilled. Finally, the WWF just had Flair win their version of the world title and scrapped the other version entirely. Years later, Hearn would admit that his decision to drive Flair from the company was the defining moment in his tenure in WCW, and it was indeed a poor one. Regret it, he laughed. It was a stupid act on my part. He was the best performer in the company, by far. To Hearn, the Flair nightmare finally appeared to be in the past. In reality, it was only just beginning. Hearn's first order of business was to crown a new champion. A plan was set in motion to do just this at the upcoming Great American Bash pay-per-view from Baltimore. WCW really needed the show to be a success. Fans had not been happy with Flair's sudden disappearance from the promotion, and they made their feelings known with chants of "We want Flair" and "Dusty sucks" at every venue. With an already irritable crowd, it was crucial that the Bash entertain fans to prove that WCW could succeed without Flair. The show rushed right out of the gate with a scaffold match. For those of you who have never seen such an encounter, a scaffold match is pretty much just what it sounds like. A scaffold is erected above the ring, and the combatants attempt to knock each other down to the floor. This type of match is not only incredibly dangerous, with the workers dropping somewhere between 15 and 20 feet from the scaffold, it's also pretty boring. After all, no one wants to get shoved off before they're ready to make the drop. The scaffold match was a feud ender. First, build up a huge rivalry between two men and have them duke it out in conventional matches to no satisfactory conclusion. Then, with no other way to resolve the matter, have them square off in a match so dangerous that it would not only settle the rivalry, but could also end careers at its conclusion. It made little sense to open the show with the match, and even less sense to open it with a bunch of mid-carders like Rapmaster PN News, a 400-pounder, who would likely have collapsed not only the ring, but also the concrete floor underneath had he made the drop. Still, the four men did their best, tiptoeing around the platform and doing everything they could to not lose their balance. After about 10 minutes of action, the bell rang. Since no one had fallen from the scaffold yet, this appeared to be a major screw-up on someone's part. But it wasn't. The match ended because one of the contestants had captured the other team's flag. This was a new rule, one that had never been instituted in a scaffold match before. Despite the fact that this had been advertised for weeks as a standard scaffold match, the rules were changed on the night of the show so that no one would have to take the fall. It was basically a bait and switch, an increasingly common theme in WCW shows. A few boos began to scatter throughout the arena. Following the scaffold match fiasco, WCW carted out cartoonish characters. A wizard, Oz, a lumberjack, Big Josh, and a hooded executioner, Black Blood, all of whom put on horrible matches. A showdown between longtime partners Ricky Morton and Robert Gibson disappointed, as did a goofy chain match featuring Sting and Nikita Koloff. The crowd, which had been presented a horrible card thus far, was on the verge of turning not only against the show itself, but against the promotion as well. And they did just that during the main event of the evening. Barry Windham pitted against Lex Luger for the WCW World Title. Lex Luger had been a major player for the company since his debut in 1987. With his chiseled physique, many pegged him as Flair's inevitable successor. He had, after all, been chasing the WCW title for the better part of the past 4 years. When the card for the Bash was first announced, it was to be Flair defending the belt against Luger, and every fan in the country believed that Luger would finally step up to the big time and win the belt, which was the plan had Hurd and Flair come to terms on the contract extension. When Flair left the company, it seemed obvious that Luger would be the next champion, although the fact that he never beat Flair himself would haunt Luger throughout his title run. While it certainly made sense that Luger would be in the main event, the other half of the match was puzzling. There was no doubt Barry Windham had been a solid performer in both WCW and the WWF for years, but he was never a true blue main event player. He'd worked a few main events, generally against Flair, throughout his tenure, but for most of 1991, he was nowhere to be found. He had been buried in a silly feud with Brian Pillman, who was running around as the masked Yellow Dog, yet another goofy, dusty creation. He was nowhere near the title scene when Flair was champion, and the sudden decree that he was the top contender to the belt seemed preposterous. Fans simply didn't buy Windham as a contender because he hadn't presented himself as one in years. The match took place within the confines of a steel cage, probably a good thing since fans had taken to throwing garbage toward the ring. Windham and Luger proceeded to entertain the fans with one of the most boring title matches in years. At this point, it seemed the crowd was just looking to release its frustration with the promotion. Random cries of "We want Flair!" began to build throughout the arena, finally culminating in a deafening chant that was clearly audible not only live, but also to everyone watching the pay-per-view broadcast. But it wasn't over yet. In a moment of infinite wisdom, WCW decided to book Luger to win the match, but not before heel manager Harley Race came out to help him. Yes, WCW turned Luger heel. The mindset being that Flair was always a draw as a heel, so Luger should try to duplicate that act. It wasn't a bad idea in theory, although comparing Luger to Flair in any way was comically absurd, but turning him on a night when so much else was going wrong probably wasn't the best idea, since it sent the crowd right over the edge. Despite everything else they were forced to endure, The one thing fans knew they could always count on was a celebration at the end of the night with a babyface champion. Instead, Luger and Race hugged to the crowd's catcalls. Presenting Luger with the belt was a problem in and of itself, since WCW was not in possession of the title at the time. Flair had taken the belt to the WWF. To solve the problem, WCW took an old regional title, the Western States Heritage title to be precise, and glued a plate that read World Champion on top of the embossed representations of Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico. The situation was starting to resemble a riot, and that was the last thing WCW needed. Not only was the promotion in no position to mend the bridge with Flair, but he was headed straight for their competition. The company had needed to turn things around when Luger was on top, and now they had to do it with Luger as a heel. So they did the only thing they could possibly do. They put Luger into a feud with Ron Simmons, a guy who had never been over and had competed primarily in tag teams throughout his entire WCW run. Simmons was granted the next title shot on pay-per-view at Halloween Havoc, live from Chattanooga, Tennessee. The most shocking thing about the entire show was that there was not one run-in or screwjob finish on the entire show, and yes, Dusty booked it. That's not to say the show was perfect or anything close to that. The kickoff bout was an extra special bonus attraction, an abomination known as the Chamber of Horrors. The object of this 10-man cage match was to strap your opponent into an electric chair, the Chair of Torture, and pull the switch. You'd think that grown men hitting each other with shrunken heads would be entertaining, at least in a morbid sense, but you'd be wrong. It didn't help that the fatal lever, kept falling down prior to the end of the match. On the plus side, the company had strapped a mobile camera to the top of the referee's head to give fans a jerky look at what was happening inside the cage. The so-called referee was such a sensation, it was never used again. The match ended with Abdullah the Butcher being electrocuted, and you can read that as shaking in the chair uncontrollably like he had ants in his pants. The remainder of the card was just a series of squash matches, followed by the Simmons-Luger match, which did little to excite the crowd, and while it wasn't bad in the ring, it was a stark reminder that Lex Luger was not, in fact, Ric Flair. There was, however, one noteworthy match, the debut of the WCW Phantom, who completely annihilated his opponent for the evening, Tom Zenk. Brilliant booking, given Zenk was scheduled to headline house shows for the title against Luger in the coming weeks. Later in the show, the Phantom was unmasked and was revealed to be Ravishing Rick Rude, one of the WWF's top heels for the past several years. It didn't make much sense not to at least promote Rude's appearance on the show. Advertising his involvement might have generated a few last-minute buys. Still, the company had a new top heel on their hands, and this would come in handy as the calendar turned to 1992. The year ended for the company with what had traditionally been their biggest show of the year, Starrcade. In the past, the show had featured the settling of feuds, and it was generally the showcase for the year's most important world title defense. This year, however, in an effort to change things, Dusty came up with the Lethal Lottery, in which randomly paired tag teams would square off against each other, and the winning pairs would take part in a big battle royal at the end of the night, the Battle Bowl. The catch in this case was that the lottery picks were so bizarre, it appeared for all the world that the draw was, in fact, random. It wasn't, but it might as well have been. The card became a weird mishmash of matches between guys who had no business being in the ring with each other. Fortunately, WCW did plot a proper ending to the night. The final pair ended up being Luger, still the world champ, and Sting, the man many fans saw as the top contender to the belt. Sting triumphed over Lex in the non-title bout to set up the one match that WCW fans were actually interested to see, a championship match between the two. The only problem was that now Luger wanted to get out of WCW just like Flair had 6 months earlier. His dream of becoming WCW World Champion had become a nightmare, and he had no desire to stick around for more We Want Flair chants. As had been rumored for over a year, the plan was to leave WCW for Vince McMahon's new World Bodybuilding Federation. Yes, Vince McMahon was starting a professional bodybuilding promotion during a time when a steroid scandal was rocking the pro wrestling industry and making national headlines. The idea was that he'd spend a year doing the bodybuilding and then likely shoot an angle that would result in him becoming a WWF wrestler. Why spend a year bodybuilding? You see, his WCW contract didn't expire until March 1993. So to get around that, instead of going to WWF as a wrestler, he left to become a bodybuilder for the WBF. The loophole allowed Luger to make big money with Vince McMahon as a character on WWF TV by making appearances on Superstars of Wrestling and a role plugging WrestleMania and the new WBF All-Stars show. None of this was a mystery to inside fans, so it was more than a bit anticlimactic when he dropped the title to Sting at Super Brawl on February 29th. Luger wasn't the only guy to depart. When rumors in wrestling got out that Dusty Rhodes was returning, Hurd was outraged. Both Petrick and Dusty told everyone that the rumors weren't true. But when Jim Hurd found out that Petrick, who had been his friend for a long time, was lying to him, he told Petrick, quote, "Either he goes or I go." To his shock, Dusty was kept on, and Hurd was fired. Sadly, before his desire to create a pair of hunchback wrestlers could come to fruition. And this is true. Why hunchbacks? What concept could be more fascinating than two wrestlers who could not physically have both shoulders pinned to the mat? Petrick, after replacing Hurd, was replaced himself by Bill Shaw. Got all that? If so, you're further ahead of the game than many were in 1992. Hurd, who after being fired by Petrick was offered a role in the TBS syndication department, but refused, was replaced by Kip Fry, who had a novel approach to the task of turning the company around. It involved, believe it or not, the wrestlers themselves. His concept was simple. Reward the men who did their jobs the best. In fact, he created a new bonus system in the company in which a $5,000 award was distributed to those who performed the best match on each pay-per-view event. Raises were also introduced. This led, amazingly enough, to workers suddenly being motivated in the ring, which in turn gave fans events worth watching. It was something new, something wholly unexpected to the boys in the back. For years, they had listened to grizzled veterans and grumpy bookers like Ole Anderson tell them to shut their mouths and just do as they were told. Anderson, in particular, would basically try to get higher-priced young talent to quit so he could bring in his old pals at a reduced rate. Of course, this wasn't what the fans wanted to see, but that mattered little to Ole. He had grown out of touch with the business, seemingly stuck in a time warp in which he and the other geezers were still the belles of the ball. After years of being held down, it looked as though the younger guys in the company, such as Brian Pillman, Steve Austin, and Tom Zenk, were about to catch a break. Unfortunately, the downside of Kip Fry's approach was that his bonuses and increased payouts to re-signing talent started to sink the company back into the hole again. One of the big issues with WCW in the early 90s was that they had a revolving door of people in charge and nobody knew what the goal was. Were they supposed to cut costs and get the budget under control? Were they supposed to spend money, bring in talent to try to compete for the number one spot in the country against Vince McMahon? Nobody could ever quite figure it out. Fry didn't last long in this environment and eventually quit the company. Kip Fry was a good guy who was challenged to rebuild WCW, but had virtually no product knowledge, said a former big-name WCW talent from that era. He got the chance to move from being an IP attorney to running a department within Turner's empire. He was and is an entrepreneurial spirit. I'm not sure why he left. Kip wasn't a vocal, strong leader, and was easily duped. He got little support from Turner upper management, none of whom liked pro wrestling except Ted. My belief is that Fry was ready to move on and may have made that clear to his bosses. Today, Fry is a professor at Duke University and president and CEO of Evo App Incorporated. Fry's successor was, of all people, Bill Watts, last seen selling its UWF to Crockett in the late 1980s after losing $50,000 per week trying to go national. The good news was, after a string of non-wrestling people attempting to steer the ship, a wrestling person was now in the office. And that's about where the good news ended. In his first few weeks in office, it became very apparent that Watts hadn't watched a single match since his company had folded. He was old school, damn it. and that's the way he liked it. Therefore, effective immediately, he was going to make WCW matches seem much more, quote, legitimate. He did this via a bizarre series of rule changes that made little sense to anyone other than old-timers like himself. He immediately instituted a ban on all moves off the top rope. His idea was that he wanted wrestling to be more realistic. Yes, jumping off the ropes is unrealistic, but bouncing off the ropes is completely believable. And guys coming off the top rope illegally behind the ref's back would get lots of heat. This was true in the 1970s. In the 1990s, this effectively killed any cruiserweight matches, which had begun to help differentiate WCW from other organizations. In fact, the 1992 showdown between Brian Pillman and Japanese sensation Jushin Liger at Super Brawl had been heralded by many fans as the best wrestling match on the entire planet. He also removed the protective mats that surrounded the ringside area. This was done in an effort to make the workers look tougher when they took bumps outside the ring, certainly tougher than those WWF guys who fell down on the pretty blue mats. Watts had an affinity for legitimate tough guys. One of his favorite performers ever was Steve Williams, who once got busted open during an afternoon card and returned to work later that night with 108 stitches in his head. Why Watts would want to encourage such dangerous working conditions by removing the mats is anyone's guess, but it did little to drum up support for the cowboy backstage. The de-emphasis of the cruiserweight division led to a lot of bad blood between Pillman and Watts, which escalated when Watts told Pillman, among numerous others, he was looking to cut his pay. Pillman had signed a big-money contract with Kip Fry, worth nearly $500,000 over 2 years. Watts, who hadn't watched any wrestling since the late 80s, and obviously hadn't seen the revolutionary Pillman versus Liger matches that had lit WCW on fire, was baffled at these numbers. He told Pillman that he wanted to cut out the incentive portion of Pillman's contract, which was ironic because Watts had spoken out against guaranteed contracts, claiming that wrestlers with guarantees had no incentive to perform. Pillman did not like this idea. Watts said the performance bonuses were based on Pillman's push, so Pillman had a choice. He could either agree to have his bonus cut as Watts had requested, or, to avoid paying out the bonus, Watts was going to have Pillman lose every night. Fine, Pillman replied. I'll be the world's highest paid jobber. Not that it mattered to Watts. It was apparent from the beginning that he cared little about what the boys thought of him. He was brought in to steer the ship away from the iceberg and stop the bleeding. He cut payroll. He eliminated catering and events. He outlawed wives and families from visiting the wrestlers backstage. And, in an apparent effort to piss everyone off, he set forth a rule that forbade any wrestler to leave the arena until the entire show was over. Even the opening match guys had to sit around for 3 hours until the final bell rang. In short, Watts was not popular among his employees. It got worse when Watt brought in a new wrestler who was immediately pushed to the moon, despite having approximately zero talent and somehow even less charisma. Why would he do this, you ask? Because, silly, it was his son, Eric. Yes, just like Dusty Rhodes, who had pushed his son Dustin up the card despite him being totally unprepared, Watts fell into the trap of bringing up his untalented son and giving him more than his fair share of the spotlight. It didn't help that Eric was hired at the same time that massive pay cuts were being made. Wrestlers who had worked for years hoping to get a push were aghast at this turn of events. Not only were the workers unimpressed, but so were the fans, and they damn near booed poor Eric out of the building on a nightly basis. One guy who did connect with fans, however, was Leon White, who worked as Big Van Vader, an import from Japan. A 400-pound powerhouse monster, Vader was booked as the top heel for the promotion, and he immediately began to lay waste to everyone in his path. No one could stop him, and within weeks, fans knew that only one guy had a prayer of doing him in. Sting. This was classic pro wrestling booking, as the unstoppable heel faces the plucky, popular babyface champion. Even more shockingly, WCW didn't drop the ball with Vader, as he defeated Sting in a stellar match at the Great American Bash and established himself as a viable world champion both to the fans and to the boys behind the curtain. After defeating Sting, Vader was inexplicably booked to drop the title to Ron Simmons, the guy whose feud with Lex Luger had failed to generate much interest the year prior. Actually, it wasn't completely inexplicable, as Watts thought that by putting the belt on Simmons and making him the, quote, first black world heavyweight wrestling champion, and keep in mind this term was being used by WCW here in 1992, not 1972, he would be able to duplicate the success he'd attained in his old Mid-South promotion with the Junkyard Dog. But while Dog was charismatic and adored by the fans, Simmons was merely passable on the mic and garnered little reaction. It didn't help matters that he was booked in world title bouts with lifelong mid-carders like the Barbarian. A champion, after all, is only as good as the folks he beats, and the fans knew that beating a stiff like Barbarian meant nothing. Worse, despite being champion, he worked the 1992 Halloween Havoc, one of the worst shows of all time, incidentally, in the semi-main event position under a Sting versus Jake Roberts coal miner's glove match main event, where Jake's snake accidentally bit him in the face during the match, 2 weeks before Jake checked himself into rehab at the Betty Ford Clinic. Simmons needed all the help he could get to be perceived as a main event champion, and positioning him below Sting and Roberts made him come off even less as the top guy. On the bright side, he was positioned better here than he was the following month when he was one half of a mid-card tag team match at the Clash of the Champions, or at Starrcade, WCW's biggest show of the year, when he was sixth from the top on a 9-match card. The experiment to failure, Simmons dropped the belt back to Vader on December 30th in Baltimore. Watts' style of running a promotion may have worked in the mid-80s, but he seemed to have no clue about how to change with the times, nor any inclination to do so. You may be noticing a trend with WCW bookers here. But it wasn't just his wrestling philosophies that were outdated. Watts' people skills were lacking as well. He was used to being his own boss, not answering to a bunch of suits. Watts' temper was definitely not his ally, and it led to shouting matches with those who disagreed with his tactics. Everything came to a head as the result of an interview he had done prior to his hiring in the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter. In the 1991 interview, he stated that he believed restaurant owners shouldn't have to serve blacks or gays, using, it should be noted, much more offensive terminology, if they didn't want to. The interview flew under the radar of Turner management for over 18 months. Then, in late 1992, a former employee of the Cincinnati Reds claimed the team owner Marge Schott had made a number of very disparaging racial slurs that ended up getting her suspended from the day-to-day operations of the team for the 1993 season. Home run leader Hank Aaron, at the time the vice president of the Atlanta Braves, had supported the suspension in an interview with the New York Times. A month later, he just happened to show up at Starrcade. Noting that Aaron had appeared at a show booked by Watts, Mark Madden of the Torch faxed Aaron the interview Watts had done 18 months earlier, asking for comment. Aaron immediately took the interview to TBS president Terry McGuirk, and the next day, Watts announced his resignation. Watts was able to pull off one final huge coup before his departure. By the end of 1992, Watts was in dire straits and knew there was only one man who could bail him out. Ric Flair. Yes, that Ric Flair. The same guy who had departed the company under the Jim Herd regime, the same guy fans had been chanting for since his departure. In an effort to boost WCW's sagging ratings, Watts decided to air classic Flair bouts, such as those with Ricky Steamboat and Terry Funk. It worked! Flair was simultaneously a star in WWE and pulling good ratings for WCW on main event. Despite achieving success in the WWF in the form of a pair of world titles, Flair's run on top was coming to an end. After dropping the WWF title to Bret Hart in Saskatchewan, Flair knew he could make an immediate impact in WCW if he returned. With WCW waving huge money his way, Flair went to McMahon and asked to be released. McMahon had always told him that if he was ever unhappy with his position in the company or wanted out, all he had to do was ask. And McMahon was true to his word, giving Flair his release and asking only that he put over one of his top stars, Mr. Perfect, Kurt Hennig, in a Loser Leaves Town match on an early episode of the company's new flagship program, Monday Night Raw. It was a clever move by McMahon. Instead of leaving fans with the perception that Flair had voluntarily left WWF to go to greener pastures in WCW, it appeared that Flair had been forced out of WWF.